Right. Thank you, Sue. Good afternoon and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is January 6th, 2021. I am Louise Bjorkman. I am joined on this panel this afternoon by Judges Diane Bratfold and Jeffrey Bryan. And the next matter on our calendar for oral argument is In re the Welfare of the Children of SFS and MAB. Although we are proceeding by Zoom today, the rules are still the same. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. It's important that you state your name and identify the party that you represent at the beginning of your argument. And counsel for appellants, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal should you choose to use it. So with that, Mr. Mack, you may proceed.
John Mack, attorney at law, New London, Minnesota, for the father. I submit that the facts which arise between the first TPR and the second TPR are relevant to the determination of the second TPR. It would be disastrous for courts to make a blanket ruling that subsequent facts that happen between the two TPRs are irrelevant. Let me give you a reason to think that. Suppose the facts are these, that the parent wins below and the government takes an appeal and wins and gets a remand. And suppose that between the victory of the parent and the remand, the parent is convicted of rape. Surely that wouldn't be irrelevant to the determination of the second TPR. Well, that should apply for every TPR where there's been a substantial passage of time between the first order and the second order. The crucial issue in any TPR is what the present situation of the parent and the child are. Present situation, not the situation that obtained at the time of the first TPR. In the instant case, the crucial facts upon which determination was based have changed substantially. The father is no longer living with the mother. The father has achieved sobriety. The father has become employed. The father has gotten rid of a purported OFP. All of these things, therefore, are important and should have been taken into consideration. In this case, the question should be not whether the district court had a right to refuse to hold a hearing. It had that right. The first order said that. The question is whether it had a right not to hear the appellant's motion indicating why there should be amended findings. And I submit that a party always has the right to be heard if that party makes a proper motion. I did. Secondly, the right of an appellant to withdraw his agreement is fundamentally affected by the order on remand. The JRR case indicates that relevant facts must be found independent of any agreement by the parent to the TPR. And the facts in this case, as remanded, eviscerate the agreement to terminate. First, if an appellant has been told that he must agree that there were sufficient facts to show that termination was in the best interest of the child, he might not have agreed to terminate. Second, one of the critical bases for termination has not been agreed to, that is, the best interests of the child. Third, after reviewing the JRR case, the appellant, via his attorney, has a new right to change his mind. And finally, where, as here, the appellant now believes that the basis for his agreement to termination has been eroded, he has a right to withdraw that agreement. He thinks it has been eroded for the reasons I indicated above. If the appellant had known then what he knows now regarding his rehabilitation, he would not have agreed to the termination, or he might not have agreed to the termination as indicated. Now, as to the changes in circumstances, and I think this is how our case differs from JS, as I read the JS case, the Court of Appeals in particular came down on the fact that the appellant couldn't show sobriety, that the most important thing with regard to the termination of parental rights was her use of meth, and that she wasn't able to show evidence of substantial withdrawal from meth use. In this case, however, the fundamental facts have changed drastically. MB has maintained his family home and he lives there alone. The allegations of domestic abuse against him have been dismissed. He has been continuously employed at ECO Water Systems. He has passed every drug test that the county has required of him. He believes that his ability to parent has improved markedly since January of 2020. He has never used illegal drugs. He has treated his anxiety disorder successfully and made all his appointments. He has been in treatment with Stephanie Olson. He is now in a healthy relationship with his now girlfriend. And I submit this is fairly important. This was a fairly weak case to begin with, and the Court of Appeals did not rule on the other issues in Beauchere's 1. The Court of Appeals in Beauchere's 1 reversed based upon JRR, saying that the court has to take into consideration the issue of best interests of the child.
But Mr. Mack, let me just stop you there. I want to talk about the arguments you advanced on behalf of your client in the first appeal. As I understand it, you argued that there, you know, you challenged the lack of best interest findings, and you also argued that because of the lapse of time between, you know, the district court proceeding and the proceeding before our court, that there should be, that the remand should include a new trial on all issues. This court rejected that, didn't it, in its order opinion, simply returning it for the district court to make the required best interest findings?
Judge, I think you're half right. Certainly the second part, that it remanded to do a best interest finding, is what it did. But what it didn't do is rule on the other issues, like new trial, like improvement over previous matters. So I submit that if you look carefully at the first, call it MB1, you don't find any kind of findings saying we disagree with appellant on issues 1, 2, and 3, but we think they we're going to reverse and remand on issue 4.
But don't by implication we read that because you asked for broader relief than this court ordered in the first appeal? Doesn't the implication suggest that this court rejected your other arguments in terms of what the scope of the remand should be?
I think the problem is that that courts of appeals decisions should not be determined by implication. The court had every right to say, we reject A, B, and C, and didn't do it. And it knew that it shouldn't. I recall when we had our colloquy with regard to this issue before the district court, the district court said, oh, I wish that the Court of Appeals had explicitly ruled on the other matters so that I could make a determination. And I think she's right. I think you can't do it by implication. Now,
if I could jump back in here. You had stated, I believe I heard you say that the findings in the, as you call it, the first TPR, were deficient because the record, I guess, is more to the point, was deficient because I think I heard you say that the district court did not ask, or that appellant did not admit, that a voluntary termination was in the best interest of the children. Is that what did I hear you correctly?
Slightly different from that. I think that that he may have issued some kind of statement that it was not in the best, that it was in the best interest of the children, but he did not know that he had an independent right to have a court make that finding, regardless of whether he did it or not. Now for the part that I hate to go.
What's the authority that says he is that there's some requirement that he make a statement that he understands what the court has to find? I understand that there's a requirement he gives up certain rights, which he does, trial rights and whatnot. But is there a case that says he has to acknowledge that the court has to make findings based on three best interest factors? Is there a case that says he has to acknowledge what the court has to do?
Oh, I'm sure there isn't, because JRR is so recent that issue hasn't come up before the court. But ordinarily, a person who is giving up his rights has to do so voluntarily and knowingly. And he has to know, therefore, what the court has to find independent of what he says. If he had known that that was the case, he would have had the right, and he may very well have refused to terminate by agreement. Now, if I may, I'd like to go to the part of the case that bothers me most, and I sort of hate to go into it. but I think the district court exhibited animus toward the appellant. It threatened to tape his mouth shut when he was apparently making a funny face. It refused to permit him to proceed in formor pauperis in the first appeal, claiming that the appeal was frivolous when the Court of Appeal ordered the district court to grant him formor pauperis status. It issued its order on remand before the 20-day waiting period expired, thereby obstructing any input from appellant's counsel. Appellant's counsel had made prepared a motion for amended findings, but held off serving it until the 20-day period was up. The district court limited the rights of the court-appointed counsel after it had issued its order on remand to explain the case to MB. Well, explaining a case, of course, is meaningless. What is important is that the trial counsel have the right to bring motions for relief, including the motions that I made. And that goes to what finally put me over the edge. I had made this motion for amended findings, rather extensive amended findings. And the court not only refused to hear the motion, but it made its findings before I was even able to serve my motion for amended findings. And of course, the court knew that I was going to make those findings and was going to make that motion before the court as soon as the 20-day period was up. I find that this very problematical, especially the taping of someone's mouth shut. Obviously.
Mr. Mack?
Yes.
I want to interrupt because I want to get a sense for sequence. As I understand it, there was a motion made in February, shortly after the, as you call it, the first TPR. A motion was made at that point, and as part of that motion was a request to withdraw from the admission. And if you look at what was included at that time, I don't see anything at that point regarding duress or regarding the statement about duct tape. What is there in paragraph 9 of the affidavit is three reasons why appellant believes that he was coerced. Number one, the court failed to exclude some evidence. Number two, the court denied a request for a six-month extension of timelines. And three, a refusal from the agency to allow trial home visits. Nothing in there about duress, nothing in there about duct tape. So the question I have then is, if that wasn't in the February 14th motion, and if I look at the September 4th motion, I also don't see a mention of that. What I see is a basis for the request to withdraw on September 4th is Mr. Boshier's head is in a much better place. He has been determined to be drug-free. He has sought and received treatment. That's it. So what is it that you can point to that shows that this duress argument is properly preserved?
Two things. One, I think that an issue of bias by the court, I didn't have enough to say that, to say, by the way, that was the coercion. The problem is bias by the court is in and of itself a reason to reverse. But to go into it, I was reluctant to bring this up in issue one, probably out of cowardice, if nothing else. But what finally put me over the edge are some of the things that the court did after remand, such as, for example, not hearing my motion for amended findings. Had it agreed to do that, I suppose I would have bitten my tongue and simply left that out. But I think that there's been so much evidence of animus of this court before MB that that in alone is a reason to reverse, because prejudice on the part of a court is a reason to reverse.
Mr. Mack, did you seek to remove the district court judge at any point during these proceedings?
Well, I was never before the district court judge. The district court was handled by another client. And then before I even got the opportunity, for example, in the 20-day period to do anything before this court, the case was immediately decided and I appealed. So I wouldn't have had an opportunity to remove this judge. I think one of the things that bothers me is if you look at the record as a whole, this was a fairly weak case against Mr. Boshears. And the big reason for the case was, frankly, aggression toward his wife and the fact that he was drinking. Now he's sober. Now the mother is out of the picture. There is no longer an indication that that would be a danger to the children or would be looking bad in front of the children. For that reason, given that it's a fairly weak case anyway, and the numerous errors that I point to, the case should be remanded.
Thank you, counsel. You will have an opportunity to offer rebuttal argument. Mr. Is it Reinke? You may proceed.
Close enough that I won't correct you, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
You can tell me what it is. In any event, it's time for respondent's argument. You may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Sean Reinke, and I'm here on behalf of the respondent, Swift County Human Services. On behalf of the respondent, I'm asking this court to deny appellant the relief he seeks and to affirm the orders of the district court. As I see it, the appellant raises three identifiable issues. First, that the district court erred in not reopening the record and considering his new evidence. Second, that the district court erred in declining to permit him to withdraw his voluntary admission for termination. And third, the animus and bias. Before I get into my analysis of the issues, I want to touch on a couple of questions that this court raised. Judge Bjorkman, I believe you asked about whether or not Mr. Mack had sought to remove the judicial officer. And the answer to that, as I review the record, is no. I realize Mr. Mack indicated that he had not appeared before the trial court. However, Mr. Mack was the attorney of record for the motion for amended findings and new trial that was filed prior to this appeal. So I would argue and posit that that issue could have been raised in that motion.
Mr. Reinke, on the bias issue, do you see that you identified it as a third separate issue? And I'm curious to see what you think, because since there is no motion to remove, isn't it basically that the reason why the district court may have abused its discretion in denying the motion for amended findings or new trial and in denying the request to withdraw, if the reason is because the district court was biased, that's why the appellant now would say it's an abuse of discretion. So in other words, it's not a separate issue, but it's an attack on the reasoning behind and therefore an attack on the discretion exercised in denying the two motions.
Thank you, Your Honor. And respectfully, I would disagree with that analysis. The reason being, number one, I think the court needs to remember that on these issues of judicial propriety, there's a presumption that the court acted within reason in making the things and doing the things that it did. Second, and I think this goes more to Your Honor's question, is if there were no other reason to deny the request that appellant sought in his motion, perhaps you could attack the propriety of the judicial officer. Here, however, if we look at that motion to vacate the voluntary termination, the law is clear in the KT and the NMC decision that in order to vacate a voluntary termination, the moving party must make a prima facie showing that there's good cause to do so, a serious and compelling reason to do so, and they have to show fraud, duress, and undue influence. And if you look at the pleadings in this case, if you look at the memorandum and the affidavit that the appellant filed, nowhere in that memorandum or affidavit does it talk about fraud, duress, or undue influence. It also doesn't address the impropriety of the court. So I think because the district court had ample reason to deny these requests separate and apart from any type of claim of impropriety, that it does remain a separate and distinct issue. I'd also like to talk about a comment that the appellant made during oral argument here. I believe the quote was that he has the right to change his mind, referring to the appellant having the right to change his mind on the termination. And that issue is directly addressed in the NMC opinion, where the court found and held that a parent does not solely have the right to change their mind. They have to make that prima facie showing of fraud, duress, or undue influence, along with a serious and compelling reason to uproot the children. The reason for that is because the Minnesota courts have long recognized that permanency is in these children's best interests. That's why we have the timelines just compelling filing of the termination or permanency petitions, is because the courts and the state recognize that in order to best serve the interests of these kids, we need to move along and get the resolution sooner rather than later. So rather than uproot the children because a parent has changed their mind, we have the standard that the moving party, the appellant, must show in order to move forward. Looking at appellant's first issue, which is the requirement that the district court consider new evidence, I see no basis compelling the district court to do so. In fact, I see language in the Jansen and the Duffy opinions requiring that the district court look at the orders for remand from this court and follow the directions of this court. And if the court gives a specific instruction, then the district court must follow that. But where it gives an indication to make additional findings or simply a guideline, then the district court has the discretion to do as it seems most fit to follow the directives of this court. In the first appeal, the directive of this court was to make those Rule 58.04 findings, make those JRR findings. And the district court did so based on the facts and evidence that it had before it. Fact number one being the signed written affidavit that the appellant signed terminating his parental rights or consenting to the termination. Hearing the oral argument from the appellant, reading through the briefs, I think there's a misapplication of how this case might rule if it were an involuntary termination following a trial. The appellant makes great hypotheticals and statements regarding what would happen in a future case if this had come differently, or how he might have changed his case. There's an often statement reported that this was a weak case. And I would submit to the court that the strength of the underlying petition is not so much relevant at this stage when we have a voluntary termination. I think we could go down that rabbit hole if this were an involuntary case, but in this case, we have a voluntary termination, a consent to voluntarily terminate. And I think for that reason, we have to look at the law that applies there, which is the standard I discussed just a few moments ago. I don't see any case law either in this state or any of the extra jurisdictional cases that Mr. Mack cited requiring the court to hear evidence. All of the extra jurisdictional cases support a permissive reopening of the record unless otherwise directed by the reviewing court. There was one case cited by the appellant that required testimony be opened, and I'd submit there's nothing to prohibit this court from making such a directive. The appellant is asking this court to establish some sort of bright line rule about when the district court should and should not reopen a case. I believe that such a rule is not necessary because it already exists in the remand order that might come down from this court in any given case. The appellant's brief acknowledges that this is a unique situation not likely to repeat itself. I would urge the court to exercise caution in establishing some form of bright line rule that could apply to cases going forward for such a unique situation such as the one here.
Mr. Ranke, do you make a distinction between the district court reopening the record and the district court allowing appellant to withdraw from the voluntary agreement? Or are those the same thing?
Your Honor, in this case, I believe that we could apply them in the same way. A distinction could be made under certain circumstances. Certainly the issue before the court on the remand was, does it have enough information to make those Rule 58.04 findings? If the district court reviewed the record and determined that it did, which it did in this case, then it can issue that order without having to reopen. However, if the appellant were to file a motion asking to reopen the case, consider new evidence, somehow allege that the record was insufficient and that that insufficiency led to some analysis with the Rule 58, then they could be intertwined.
Okay, so I guess if you have a voluntary termination and you're going to reopen the record, aren't you only reopening it to ask some additional questions or get an additional statement, an admission? And so if that is true, what was missing, if anything, from the original admission?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that Your Honor absolutely is correct in that in this case, the sole issue on remand was how do we make the findings required by Rule 58.04? And I would just have to note that at the time of the original termination, JRR had not yet been issued. So this all came about after that. But if the record needed to be reopened, the sole point in reopening would be to make sure that we get facts and information relative to Rule 58.04, not to necessarily go outside that, not to consider new information.
And to layer on top of that, the nature of a voluntary termination, you're not receiving additional evidence, right? You're asking additional questions if you need be.
Correct. Yep. And those questions would be relating to that parent's interest that they might then be relinquishing by signing that voluntary termination. And then, of course, in this case, the district court reviewed the record and the information before it, and by issuance of its order, determined that such additional information was not necessary.
Do you think that the statement made at the time of the voluntary termination, I guess the question was asked, and appellant indicated that he believed, quote, he believed it is in the best interest of his children that he voluntarily consent to terminate his parental rights and that there's good cause to do so, that he agrees with that statement. Is that sufficient after JRR for a court to then apply the best interest findings it needs to?
I believe it is, Your Honor. The reason is you have to look at the totality of the evidence, not just any given statement in and of itself. You must look at everything. And I would also add that the appellant is not challenging the sufficiency of the Rule 58 findings, as I understand it in this case, only whether or not the record should have been reopened as a matter of what appears to be due process. So no, I do believe that the statement given by the appellant, both on his signed affidavit, the evidence as a whole that had been submitted to the court, along with the fact, Your Honor, that appellant was represented by counsel throughout the entirety of this proceeding, all the way through the CHIPS proceeding and through the signed voluntary termination through to today. I recognize that as part of the impartiality argument that the appellant is raising an issue regarding the appointment of counsel, I would simply point out to this court that if you look at document 9 in the index, which is the order appointing counsel for the father at the admit deny hearing for the TPR, the court makes a similar finding as it did in its remand order, which is that counsel is appointed for the purpose of one hearing and then needs to reapply. I don't believe that the appointment sua sponte of counsel for the benefit of a parent is indicative of any type of impropriety. Rather, I think that that goes the opposite way. The court had no obligation to appoint counsel, yet it did so to ensure that the appellant had an understanding of his rights and knew how he could best proceed. I think, Your Honors, when you look at the evidence as a whole in this case, you keep in mind that this is a voluntary, not an involuntary termination. No other conclusion can be reached other than the district court made the appropriate call, made the appropriate findings, made the appropriate order. It did not show any type of abject antipathy towards the appellant. It acted appropriately. It made the necessary findings. And based on the assumptions, the standards of review that apply on all of the three issues that are before this court, that I believe that the court has no choice but to affirm the district court. I don't go into any arguments made by the appellant that allegedly stem from the first appeal. As I read through the brief in the first appeal, I believe that Judge Bjorkman, you identified the issues perfectly, which were simply that the findings were insufficient in light of JRR and whether that this should be remanded. And I would submit that those were both addressed in this court's initial order from the first appeal, and that we're simply looking at the three issues I identified here. And based on that, I'd ask that this court affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Mack, you have 5 minutes for rebuttals.
Yes. I've never denied that the judge in this case would have had the right to make findings without holding an additional hearing, because the court in the first case said so. What I'm complaining about, though, is that it didn't give me an opportunity to be heard. I made a motion. The court knew that I was making the motion and should have allowed me to be heard. The rules are pretty clear that a party has a right to its input and has a right to be heard. And I was making that second motion with all those indications that I've made to the court today. Even worse in this case.
But Mr. Mack, then it seems to me your beef, if you will, is really with this court, because as I look at the language of our order, we specifically said the district court may but need not entertain arguments or reopen the record. And now you're talking about your ability to make an argument, which again, I think this court in our order on remand said the district court had discretion to permit or not permit.
Yeah, I submit that is not a fair reading, that in this case, I had a right to make a motion, and that's what the court didn't hear. I don't think the language precludes me from making a motion or having input, and I think the general rule of fairness allows me to have input. Now, let me speak briefly to the argument that in order to withdraw, one has to have either fraud, duress, or something similar. I submit that JRR has changed that. Now we have a ruling that says best interest has to be determined independently. Now, best interests and the fact that it has to be determined independently is a very important consideration for counsel and a very important consideration for the person thinking of making an admission. JRR makes it pretty clear, and the language makes it pretty clear, that we're supposed to look at the best interest of the child as the overriding factor. And the fact that somebody says, well, it's in the best interest of the child, doesn't make it in the best interest of the child. When I say that a person has a right to change his mind, it isn't a matter of changing his mind without thinking. It's a matter of changing his mind after he has made considerable progress in the sorts of things that caused the TPR to be made in the first place. Certainly he is in much better position now than he was at the time of the TPR, and I don't think that that should be overlooked. Thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory period. That concludes our oral calendar for today. Thank you both. And we will take, I guess, recess now.